Okay, so this next section is going to be talking about building your first work plan. And we've already kind of skirted some of those issues. We've discussed the importance of being able to keep track of where you're supposed to be in a project and who has responsibility for things. This is where Jen was talking about boot camp and demos. That is a way of keeping track of large, complicated projects. But work plans are also a fundamental part of the process of writing a proposal. They are generally a required component of them. And it's really good practice to go through this process to organize your thoughts, to make sure that what you are wanting to do is feasible, both within the time that you have and with the resources that you have. Time, of course, obviously being a resource. So, what are the sort of things that you should think about when you're beginning to develop a work plan? You need to create an itemized list of the specific tasks that will be necessary to complete your project. You can't be too detailed at this point. You need to think through all of the little things. It might be something as simple as registering a domain name or requesting a server space on your university campus. Right the way through to, I have to develop this piece of code. It might also include things like marketing, final dissemination, and it will include things like the writing of your white paper and your technical report to your sponsor. So it has to include, you have to think through the entire process of a project and all of the different components that we've kind of already talked about to a large extent. But the idea at this point is to be as specific as you can while you're planning it through so that you can assign individual responsibilities. So you know who is going to be responsible for buying the web space, or for doing the code, the coding, or for writing the final report that goes to NEH. There should always be a time element to this. So there's absolutely no point writing the final white paper in month one of your project. You know? So you have to think through the logical structure of how the project is going to come together. But also you have to think about how long each element might take. So buying the domain space is probably only going to take 5 minutes, whereas writing the code for your customized solution, topic modeling solution, might take 6 months. So you have to think about what are appropriate lengths of time, what are realistic lengths of time to carry out the tasks that that you will need to do to complete your project. And then finally, what you need to do is describe what the deliverable or outcome of each task is. There's no point having a task if it isn't connected to the overall scope of the project. How does each task fit in to what it is that you are ultimately trying to achieve? And it's like Lego blocks, right? Each task builds up to a completed whole. So how do we do this? The very first step, as I say, is to list every major objective. So at this point, you're not going to list buying server space, but you are going to list coding. You are going to list development of a website, that sort of thing. But then you need to think through the sub-steps that will be necessary to make that happen. So if the end product of your project is, for example, a online exhibit of historic Mac computers, because I happen to be looking at that cabinet over there, you know, you're going to think through, okay, what are some of the steps that are going to be necessary for me to do that? Well, I might be taking photographs of each of these artifacts. So there's the component of collecting my data set. There's then the process of putting that into, of identifying and putting that into some form of digital repository. And then finally, there's there might be a step of presenting that and making that available onto a website. So photographing, your individual steps might be to train a student in how to most effectively capture a digital artifact, what metadata standards they should be adding to the digital file so that you know what on earth it is that he has taken a photograph of. And then you need to think about, okay, what is the process that I need to do when I add it to my digital repository? Is there additional metadata that needs to be added? Is there specific coding that needs to be done to that? And then finally, when you're putting it on the website, it's identifying what system I'm going to be using to display it. It's where is the data going to be stored? What URL am I going to be using? Those sorts of things that you have to think through and deal with. So the first time you do this, the first time you do a digital humanities project, the best way to think about this is everything is a task that should be assigned to someone, even if that someone is yourself. When you're on your second and third project, a lot of these things will become second nature to you and you'll just do them and you don't have to think about them. And some of the more basic things in this will never actually see the light of day in terms of a formal work plan. But it's really important for you to think it through and know what you need to do to make the project a success. So once you've gone through and you've identified all of your different tasks, you need to assign a responsibility to it. And a task might have a responsibility of a team. If it's a big, big significant part of your project, you might have multiple programmers working on the development of your customized digital repository, in which case you would assign it to the programming team. Or it might simply be a task that is assigned to an individual. The white paper will likely be written by the project manager, who might very well be you. That person will have the individual responsibility for it. They might then delegate some of the responsibility of providing content to other members of your team, but you need to know who the principal person is who you as the project manager can go to when things start to go wrong or don't happen. For every task, list the deliverable. It's pretty obvious, you know. Say why it is that you're including that task there. Why does this build into the overall goals of your project? Think about how do you know that the task is finished? If you're writing code, it might be that the developed code does what it is that you have described in your proposal. It might be a receipt. You know, if you are purchasing a new server, the delivery of the machine and the actual physical receipt will be evidence that you have that whoever it is has done what they need to do. Also, think about where the completed task will go, physically or digitally. You need to think through storage issues. You need to think through physical infrastructure issues. But for every task, list the amount of time required from start to finish. So that way you can start to see that a project that is, you can get a sense of how long the project ultimately is going to be. If there is a task that cannot begin until, if task B cannot begin until task A has been completed, and task A is a 6-month project, that allows you to plan not only the overall length of the of the of your project, but it also allows you to think about how you are going to assign individuals. It allows you to think about when you need to hire a graduate student. It might be that if you are working on a single-year project, that you have a history student who is going out and collecting old documents, and he's doing that in your first semester, and then in your second semester, you turn it over to a computer scientist who will run some form of algorithm on it. So by thinking about the time element, you're not only creating the scope of the project, you're beginning to think about staff allocation, you're starting to think about most effective use of your time, which means you're starting to think about most effective use of your money. And money is a very valuable commodity when you're doing digital humanities research. Yeah.
So you say, like, in this semester you might be doing this. And so in, like, NEH-funded projects, for example, are these usually on a semester or by semester basis? Or, like, I'm just kind of wondering how these get kind of schedules map up with academic year versus...
Oftentimes with great difficulty, honestly. I mean, the funding... When you submit a proposal, you get to say, this is my preferred start date, oftentimes. Other times, NEH will say in the solicitation, this is for projects beginning in April 2014. And so you're kind of working, so it depends a little bit on the requirements of the sponsor. And you do have to work within that. Because as you say, if you have a project that starts in April, that's actually a really bad time of year in terms of hiring graduate students, because they're right at the end of their academic year. So really, you can't, if graduate students, research assistants, are going to be your primary labor force, you're not going to get very much done until August, September, when you can actually start hiring them in a lot of cases. So you do kind of have to think along those lines. It's it can be a challenge. The advantage is that a lot of these sponsors are generally very good about what are called no-cost extensions. So you can, if you put together a 12-month project or an 18-month project, and you find that it actually takes longer, it's taking longer to do it than you anticipated, as long as you haven't actually spent the money, they are often very good about allowing you to extend it for another 6 months or another 12 months. So that's another way of getting around it. But the thing to do is to look at what the anticipated start date is. If it's something that you can define, that's fantastic. If it's something that the sponsor can defines, and they say that it's going to start in April, and you know realistically you're not going to be able to get much done until your research assistant starts in August, then think about framing it as an 18-month project instead of a 12-month project, so you get that full academic year. And what you can often do. Is use that 6 months for some form of exploratory work, or you can hire, instead of a research assistant who comes with the tuition waiver and a guaranteed salary, you could hire a hourly student who are often easier to find, especially over the summer months, where they're looking for some pocket money to supplement their drinking.
The other thing, you know, in terms of start dates and end dates, is that it takes time for the university HR to process things like job descriptions mm-hmm. that are going out to hire a student or to hire somebody external to your team. It takes time to process the financial paperwork that opens the account that you then begin charging to. So it's worthwhile having a conversation with whoever does that activity in your department or your college or your university and saying, how long does it usually take you to open an account? How long does it normally take for us to process paperwork to open up a job search or something like that? They'll tell you what their preferred timeline is. And it's important that becomes the starting point for your project because you don't want to think you're going to get the money on day one, hire everyone on day one, and the project starts on day two. It's not going to happen. In the same way, at the end of the project, you want to build on 2 or 3 or 4 weeks to do things like wrap up your data, write your reports, do all of the things that are sort of closure activities, have your final meeting, you know, get your financial reports from whoever does your budgets, things like that.
I think, yeah.
In your mind, what's the difference in step one between a major objective and step three, a deliverable? And I guess I'm asking, is there ever an objective that doesn't have a deliverable?
Yes.
What would be an example of that?
So deliverables are concrete products.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, your objective could be to determine with your team the meaning of the people you want to approach for a partnership. The deliverable from that could be a partnership agreement, but the deliverable could also just be that we had the conversation. Do you see what I'm saying? And so,
the deliverable in that case would be the list of
you would hope. But there are conversations that you can have that don't actually result in deliverables, particularly around things like making sure everyone in the team understands who Shelley is, for example, or what the historical questions are, or making sure everyone's on the same page in terms of understanding, you know, what a tool we're using. So, you know, doing a tool training, bringing everybody in and training them for Omeka, that's something where there's a work plan item. And there's not really a specific, what I call a deliverable for that is like everyone has competency and that's the deliverable. But in reality, there's nothing tangible that comes out of that. And I think, so there are some things
yeah.
that don't
so
always have direct deliverables.
The objective is like the abstract, whereas the deliverable is the specific. You know, what is it that you want to achieve from your objective? Yeah.
In terms of list of tasks, we put on conferences that we're going to attend in order to
mm-hmm.
the product to the product audience. Do you put those in the timeline like together or as they come the calendar year?
As they come,
absolutely. You know, because what you are doing, what you're doing by that is you're indicating the point in your work plan when you think that you are going to be comfortable to start delivering public results. So oftentimes, you know, if for example you have a 2-year work plan. Oftentimes, starting in year 2 or even starting in sort of quarter 3 or 4 of year 1, we'll start having attending conferences as specific items within the work plan. And if you know of specific conferences that you are planning to attend, then yes, absolutely. You know, you put those in as specific goals and specific objectives that you're going to be ready.
The objective would be like publicity. And
publicity,
control,
yes,
like
and the
users.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Okay. Any other questions about the 5 steps? 4 steps. I can't count. Okay. So here's an example of what all of this might look like. They've already seen this one, right?
No.
So this is obviously one of Jen's.
This is actually my digital companion piece to my dissertation.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
I didn't realize that was what it was.
Yeah.
But you can kind of see that how Jen has organized this. Do you want to talk about it rather than
yeah.
me?
So this is actually a work plan that I did. I have audited Lynn Seaman's project management class at DHSI last year to see how she teaches what I do. And it was awesome for me because I actually got to work on my own project for the whole week. And this is actually this is what I did for the project was, for a long time I've been on the fence about like creating a digital piece to my dissertation. And finally decided that I would use that week to really think through what I would have to do to make a digital companion piece. So what you're actually looking at is the column 1 is the unique ID, which basically is, you know, like if I had to sort for things, you know, every individual objective has a number, its own number, no brainer. A description of activities. And you'll notice that I get very micro when it comes to my own work. I draft the letter. I have comments for the letter. I revise the letter. I draft it, I revise it, I finalize it. And these are two different things, but creating those steps, because I know I'm never going to do it by myself once. I potentially have to have comments, I have to have feedback, and I create timelines that address that. So I draft the letter on the 1st, get it finished the following day if I haven't already finished it. This relies or gets assigned to me. This is part of the admin team, so this is, you know, an admin-type responsibility. The deliverable is a completed draft, and when the draft that I've done is completed, I make sure it's in Google Drive, because I need the people to comment on it in Google Drive. Make sense? So then those people start with their task. They have to comment on what I've just done. They get 10 days, because whatever, they're lazy. My entire team needs to do that. So everybody, my advisors, whoever I have engaged with my project, I need their comment on that letter, or at least give them the opportunity to comment. So it's, there you'll see, there's no person there. It's everybody. Their deliverable is to send the comments to me in Google Drive. That Drive document then gets revised by me in 2 days. This gets assigned by all. And by all, even though it's my responsibility to finalize it or to complete the revisions, oftentimes people are going to want to audit my process. In other words, there may be comments in the Drive document where we're having a conversation about something or debating something. And so I need everybody to pay attention to the revision piece because we're having a debate about something. And this is where commenting notifies you when somebody responds. But at the end of the day, even though everybody is commenting and arguing about the revision that I'm doing, it's my responsibility on August 15th to have that revision done and signed off on. And in the end, that document goes into my hard drive. And then I print out a copy and send it out. And if you scroll down later in the list, there's a thing that says mail to. Yeah.
Obviously, the dependency is which task has to be required before
yep.
this one can be done. What is the WBS column?
So that basically is a, it's like a work breakdown structure. So it's basically a level of responsibility that you can assign. So this is actually, and you're going to see this, this is a Gantt chart run work plan. So the WBS actually is the task level in terms of complexity. So these are all preliminary tasks that I value in the work plan. So the most simplest task is a 1, you know, something to start with. The more complex tasks, like revisions, get a higher value. So for me, the reason why these are all 1s, for example, is that these are all initial steps that I have to do before I can really move on from the project. And when you actually scroll down farther into this, you get, you know, larger dependencies, 4s, 5s, 7s, 8s, 10s. Because those are more complex things that if I didn't do 1 and 1.5, I'm never going to get to 18 or 24. Or actually, I think on this one, there's like 42 individual objectives and deliverables. Yeah.
Do you do this in addition to your boot camp workflow?
I usually do this myself for planning purposes. Like, when I think about what I need to assign and who assigns it, this is the type of thing that I do. I actually don't usually do this in a document like this when I do it for myth projects. I actually usually just do it on a piece of paper or post-its, and we're going to talk about that. But this is actually what's become the to-do items. This becomes the to-do items in Basecamp. So what I could do, and I actually done this, I have a project that I can do that's my project, that all of these are to-dos, here are the due dates, and this is that. And I link this document to the Basecamp. So that if there's a question about where the product goes, you can just look at the column and see. Because this isn't the full screenshot or whatever, on this document in particular, I do get as granular as sending emails. You know, it's not just things like drafting or whatever, it's like holding meetings, sending emails, putting in abstracts for conferences or presentations is on there. I mean, you can get as granular as you kind of feel comfortable with. I should also mention with this particular task list, I actually keep a version of this for everything that I do in my life for Myth. So there's a Myth Excel spreadsheet that is bi-week that literally is a running list of everything that I have to do in my life. And there's a little thing at the bottom that says completed. And every time I finish something in the top, goes down to the bottom. And at the end of the week or the beginning of the week, Neil can actually log in and look at it and see what I did that week and what else needs to come. Because there are things that I have to handle that are sensitive and can't go into Basecamp. You know, that you know, it's not good protocol to be discussing, you know, promotion for somebody. Or, you know, you're having a problem with a staff member, you kind of can't discuss that. So I keep a sort of separate private sheet that's for my, like, administrative world stuff that's not project-based. But it's really super satisfying because you can go week by week and trace my entire life, and it makes it really super easy to actually create reports of what I've done for the year.
Okay, so one of the most important parts of your work plan is how you measure time. And the answer to that really depends on what type of project you're working on and what the duration of the project, overall duration of the project is. You saw that the example that Jen was just describing had a granularity of a single day. So she knew by the day what was going to happen. Other projects might do it by the week, by the month, by the quarter, or by the year. And there isn't a easy formula for calculating what that is going to be, for what the most appropriate time measurement is going to be. It's really going to come down to the specifics of what you're trying to achieve, the complexity of it, and the amount of time that you have to do it in. Oftentimes, a multi-year project, you will see it done by either the month or the quarter. A single-year project will most likely be done by the month. I have never written a work plan that measures by the year. So it's extremely unlikely that you will ever find yourself in a situation where you want to organize your thoughts by the year. But you will likely have elements of your work plan that extend across a year. So there might be some aspect of what you are doing that is that will begin in quarter one and end in quarter four for a year-long project. Or, obviously, that might start in quarter three of year one and end in quarter two of year two, or whatever.
And I think we want to highlight, too, the lost time that disappears, and I've mentioned this already
yeah.
this week. Christmas, the month of December, from December 15th until January 15th. Simon and I both shut down, basically, our centers. Like, I don't expect anyone to turn in work between December 15th and, well, because we're running DHWI, it was January 1. But normally, between December 15th and January 15th, that's what we use as catching up on all the stuff you haven't done time. And if you get lots of stuff done, that's great. But I'm usually not going to start something new until everyone is back to campus and school has started. We basically put projects on hiatus. This is also key, by the way, the first 2 weeks after classes end and the first 2 weeks when classes start, particularly if you're a librarian. You know, when all the undergraduate students come back and you all of a sudden have to do course trainings or have to do all of the kickoff meetings for the thousands of committees you sit on. Things like that, that's what we call lost time. And so you want to take that into account when you build your work plan. You don't have to explain it to your funder why there's missing segments. But what you do is you say, I know in my head this is only going to take 2 weeks, but because it falls in December, we're going to stretch it from December 1 to January 7th. Okay, same deliverable, same amount of time in your head. It's just on the work plan that's officially external, it says it takes 4 weeks. On your version, it says it takes 4 weeks, but it's actually 2 weeks of work going on. This is particularly important, too, in terms of staffing. If you have part-time staff, taking into account that they only have a certain number of hours a week. And so if you've budgeted for 40 hours for them to work on something, that could be a month of work.
Yeah. So the best advice is actually to look at your university's academic calendar. Be familiar with when spring break is. Be familiar with, does your university observe Martin Luther King Day? In the case of Clemson, we don't get Labor Day or Memorial Day, but instead we get some weird thing called spring and fall break. And we actually have this also weird thing where the staff are required to work during that week and there are no faculty or students. So being familiar with kind of the contours of your university, yeah.
I just wanted to add, in addition to that, like, there are even more subtle ones. Like, I know from experience that professors in the English department at my university pretty much don't work in August.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But also if you're working, if you have collaborators in other countries,
yeah.
For instance, in Spain, where they have holidays every other week, there's a
Thursdays,
and then Thursday's a holiday, and then Friday they just take a day off because it's a long weekend, or...
the British holiday. Summer holiday.
British summer holiday.
Or bank days.
Easter holidays.
Bank holidays, yeah.
So yeah, just sort of, particularly if you're working multinationally, that there's going to be a whole other...
Yes.
And a good actually example of this is being aware of the fact that time zones and things like that can actually affect your work plan. So if you're working with partners who are 5 or 6 or 10 hours ahead and you want something due on Monday at 8 a.m. for you, you've got to figure out in your head they're working ahead of you. Is that them working on a Monday or is that them working on a Friday to get it done? So things like that, when you get down to the sort of granular level, that becomes more important. At this stage of your project, you are likely going to be working on a monthly or a quarterly schedule in terms of the big sort of thing, the big picture, and then hopefully breaking it down by a week. So this week I'm going to focus on this, next week I'll focus on that.
But sometimes, so I've got a project right now that has monthly deliverables, and it's... On this date, we have to do this, and it's a very specific target date, and they actually don't care. They gave us a deliverable date of December 30th, which is awesome for them, I'm sure, but for us meant that our deliverable of December 30th actually meant the deliverable was December 15th. So... being aware that sometimes deliverables are actually out of your control to an extent. So planning ahead and being aware of these situations. And yeah, international holidays are really difficult things to deal with. The best way to deal with it is to ask your partners, you know, and to make sure that everyone is on the same page so that So you give them an opportunity to say, well, actually that deliverable of January 9th isn't going to work for us because that's the celebration of whomever in our city. There's no way that you can anticipate all of this without asking them. And oftentimes you'll also find they'll forget and they'll suddenly look on their calendar and go, oh, crap. So you need to do everything you can to kind of mitigate that, but be flexible. So, how do you work out how to budget your time? For a short-term project, the best way to think about it is essentially you're working on a 40-hour week. That's not universally true. At Clemson, officially, it's a 37.5 week hour week. In the United Kingdom, it's 35 hours a week. In other places, it's 40. In others, it might be 50. Just depending on where it is. But 40 hours is a good middle ground. And honestly, the math is easy. And we're all about making life easy for ourselves. So, and where this is important is actually what we're going to be talking about tomorrow with budgets, because you need to think about what portion of your time you will be spending on this project so that you can appropriately budget that time for financial purposes as well as for the practical purposes of doing it. So 2 hours is 5% of your time. 8 hours, which equates to a single day, is 20% of your time. If you're doing a short-term project, that means that, for example, a programmer might be a 20% time programmer on this, that means that he should be spending 8 hours a week on it, which might be the equivalent of a single day, and for one day he is yours, and for the other 4 days he is someone else's. Or it might mean that he is spending 2 hours a day on your project for 4 days out of the week. How that works is going to be an important conversation for you to have, but you need to think about how you're apportioning people's time so that you can plan accordingly within your work plan, so that you can make sure that you know that, okay, this is a project that is going to require 50 hours worth of work on it, as we were just talking about. It's 50 hours worth of work. I only actually have access to my programmer for 5 hours a week. That means that this is going to take 10 weeks. If you have a longer-term project, it's often better to think about it in terms of weeks. So 40 hours per week is the equivalent by 50 weeks, because we lose the 2 weeks of the summer, of Christmas. I'm already thinking about the sun. Is the equivalent of 2,000 hours, 2,000 working hours in the year. How many people think they've actually done 2,000 hours of work last year? I think I did far more, personally.
As your collaborator,
I would
say, no, actually, you haven't.
And she's probably got a spreadsheet or something showing.
She probably does. All in my head,
baby. All in my head. But 2,000 hours seems like a lot. It means that 5% of your time means that you're spending the equivalent of 2.5 weeks on a project. 10% is 5 weeks. 20% is 20 weeks. If you're a faculty member, the odds are that your time during the semester is going to be spent on exciting things like teaching, any administrative responsibilities you have within your department, any other research that you have going on, grading, mentoring of graduate students, all of these things that eat into your time, which means that the purposes of this, you need to anticipate that you'll be spending time in the summer working on the project. So 5 weeks, 10% of your time, 5 weeks is the equivalent of basically 1 month of your summer. You've got 3 months over the summer. It's just different ways of thinking about it, and anticipating what you're going to be doing. So how do you know how long something should take? There are a couple of things that you can think about. The first is, how many dependents does it have? What do you need to do before you get there to the point where you can actually even begin it? How complex is it? There are some things that are very easy, that will literally only take 5 minutes but need to be a part of your work plan. And then there are other things that will take months and months and months. How many staff know about it? That's basically how many people are engaged on the project. The more people you have working on a specific task, the less time it will take in real terms, even if it will take the same amount of time in total man hours. Is it something that has been done before somewhere else? You can look and you can ask, how long did it take you guys to do this? We're trying to do something similar. What would be a good estimate? There are lots of people who have done not exactly the same project as you, but something similar, and who will be able to give you great advice on how long you should reasonably expect something to take, or how long you should actually battle with something before you know that it's time to say, this isn't working, we need to evaluate something else. So once you've thought through all of the objectives and all of the time-related issues associated with a work plan, how do you actually go about building something? We've listed here five potential options, which I'm going to talk about in a bit more detail. There are likely plenty more, but these are the five that you're most likely to come across. And they really range, the choice of what is right for you is going to depend a lot on what the complexity of the project is. There are some things that are well suited for particular types of tasks and others that are, that really aren't. It's also going to depend on what your comfort level is with particular ways of doing this. You know, just as with the example I had yesterday with Scrivener as my preferred writing tool, that's my personal choice. There are things that, something here will work really well for me, but will not work well for Jen. It all comes down to how you think, how you like to organize your life. So the first example is a basic Word document. And you can see that it's basically, this is a 12-month project. It's broken down roughly by month. It's actually broken down bi-monthly. So we've got, so each bullet except for the first one and randomly month 10 is grouped into two. And each bullet point refers to a specific objective and deliverable. And it's promising that in month one, they're going to conduct this technical assessment of the project, and then they're going to evaluate particular things. And it builds down creating a workflow of how you're going to go about creating your final product, which includes Braille user testing and revision of functionality right at the end of it. What this is...
Yeah, a person responsible.
Yeah, so it includes the person who has primary responsibility for it. It includes a very clear sense of how long each thing will take. And it covers pretty much all of the major elements of a project. And for a 12-month project like this, which is a relatively linear process, where each thing essentially builds on each other, this works really well.
And this is actually this is what went in with the grant. This is for the Braille SC project. You guys have this example grant in your packet. This is the work plan that we submitted. This is actually the work plan that I use to check to make sure we met our deliverables each month. But there's a second work plan that exists that is solely the technical work plan that breaks down, for example, the technical assessment. And they break theirs down by every 2 weeks. And it has, and I can ask Jen to pull the most recent copy. They're by every 2 weeks. There's the major objective and the person assigned because they have three programmers working on it simultaneously. And what's interesting is that basically what I will do at the end of this to sort of report on this work plan is I will create this document, and I will create spaces underneath my month one, so the first bullet point, and put in the technical pieces below it. So I will integrate the two work plans into one long final work plan. And there are a couple of other things. So at the bottom, when we get into the user testing piece, there will be a user testing work plan that comes about when Tina Hertzberg and I meet in March that can run independently of, or mostly independently of, the rest of the project, like having her find all the people that we're testing with, get that stuff set up. We created teams on this particular project that have individualized sort of group responsibilities, and my job as the PI that's running the process is to make sure that they all line up. But any one team is not necessarily dependent on the other or is necessarily aware of the other team's work plan all the time.
Any questions about that? I have one. What's the key organizational form of this work plan?
Time.
Okay, so it's structured based on month one, this is what we're doing, month two, this is what we're doing. Which is different to how you might organize it in Excel. In this case, the key organizing principle is activity. And what it's doing is it's saying, this is activity one. This is a grouping of activity one. So each element of 1.1, 1.2 is obviously to 1.0. They can't be conducted until that has been done. And there is overlap in time. So things are essentially being done concurrently. 2.0 is going on at the same time as 1 and 1.1. It's actually happening kind of in the middle of it. But 2.1 is absolutely going on at the same time. So this is a way in which you organize it primarily by task, rather than by time. And this is helpful when you have a more complicated project where things are going on at the same time and have differing scales attached to them.
Or when you're reliant on other people to give you feedback and you can't control their time and responsibilities, having concurrent tasks that you can move on to while you wait for someone else to do their part is a really good strategy to manage a project.
Yes. There is absolutely no point waiting to start task two whilst 1.1 is going on, because there is no direct connection between them. They're essentially different products for this. So thinking through what the relationships are between things, ensuring that you can make sure that that there isn't a bottleneck where you're unnecessarily waiting for someone else to complete a task, where you can move on with something else, is a really important thing. And this is a great way of illustrating that. We're going to move on to some more abstract ones, because neither Jen nor I really use the next two as organizing principles. This is one that I randomly Googled. But this is an example of a tree chart. And you can kind of see it begins right up here, and it lists a series of tasks, and it shows in diagram format what the relationships are. So when all of this is completed, we can move on to here. We can see that this task has to be completed as part of this, and it moves down in a linear fashion. You can introduce elements of time to this if you need to. And it's a way of illustrating at a very meta level how everything feeds into each other. So it's taking this information and rearranging it all so that you can kind of see how it all interacts with each other visually. Yeah.
Do programs like Basecamp or Microsoft Project, do they do this?
Microsoft Project will do this natively. As with most open source project management tools that are not digital humanities specific, Basecamp doesn't do it, but they have a companion thing that will, that we don't purchase and use, in part because these pretty pictures take a lot of time.
They take an awful lot of time, and they're very difficult. They look good, but actually it's really complicated. You know, how does this fit in? How does this element here fit in?
And I'm going to show you a digital humanities version of this with my own project that you guys were talking about.
A network logic chart is very similar. The principal difference is somewhere down here, there will actually be a key assigning what 1, 2, 3 actually are. The principal difference is obviously it's horizontal rather than vertical. But what it's showing here are dependencies again. It's showing that this is something that you can use hash lines, different sizes, different colors to indicate different elements of a project. So it's showing a different dependency where, yes, 17, 13, and 15 connect into 17. This relationship here is different to this relationship there. I don't recommend these. You don't want to really think about it. It will blow your mind into many, many millions of pieces. Has anyone seen one of these before? Okay, so this is what your books on project management will tell you to create. This is a Gantt chart. And we actually have a template in Google Drive that will automatically generate one of these from an Excel spreadsheet for you. These are much more useful, in my opinion. You can't really see it going along here, but this here indicates time. So this is essentially month one, month two, month three, or you know, I think in this case it's actually March 1, March 2, March 3. But you can see very clearly how different elements of the project are going to be worked on at different points in time. This list down here is your list of objectives and deliverables. The bold point is the main 2.0 task, so this would be your big objective. These are the specific tasks that go in. And you can see how here, this task occurs over this span of time. Once it's completed, we can move on to task two, and it keeps going down. So you can see what the interconnections are between them. You can see that essentially there is no need, if this line here represents a person, you can see here that you only actually need to employ them for these 4 or 5 months here. You can then let them go off, do some other project, and they'll eventually come back at this point here. So this is a great way of assigning tasks, of assigning labor and manpower, and seeing visually what's going on. Yeah.
I'm going to actually show
we
you.
Will dem- we will absolutely demo it.
You're going to see the Gantt chart for it and how it works. Yeah.
But yeah, basically what it does is it takes a task or a person, and it takes a, if we go back to our spreadsheet here, what it does is it takes this information here. This is the line that it's drawing. So on your calendar, it would draw a line that extends from 1st of August to the 2nd of August. Then what it's doing is it's looking down this list of dependencies, and it's saying, oh, this task 1.1 relies on the completion of 1 before we can begin. So it will then draw that arrow that points down to 1.1, and it connects it that way. But yes, there are actually Excel plugins and scripts that will automatically, that once you've set up something like a template like this, you plug it in, you click the button, it does it for you.
And you've got one of those in your templates, and we're going to
yes.
show you what it looks like.
Yes. Yeah, we will absolutely demo this for you, because Gantt charts are actually, if the three diagrammatic ones, they're the easiest to use, and they're the easiest to understand.
And the easiest to change.
And the easiest to change, yes. Okay, so ways to improve your work plan. Color. Color is awesome, especially since you're submitting your proposal digitally, which means you don't have to worry about printing stuff off. PDFs... obviously allow you to reproduce colors exactly. So assign different people different colors so you can visually see who is responsible for what. Or assign different tasks, different specific objectives, different colors.
So everything that's a programming task is purple. Everything that's a design task is blue.
Everything that's a project management task is red, because you know those are the scary ones. create modules. What do you mean by that, Jen? You wrote this slide.
So we create modules. Basically, we identify teams and types of work that are interdependent, and we identify, and this goes down to the supervisor responsibility. So by color coding everything and then creating everything so that it sorts, so I create a category that has admin, or you can select admin, tech, design, whatever your categories and teams are. I can then actually sort that and automatically generate a chart that's exclusive to that group.
that I can hand over and say, this is what you've got to worry about. So the modular aspect of it is by assigning it to a sort of meta team or a meta group, all of the things that a partner is responsible for, all of the things that a library or, you know, whoever is responsible for, it makes it super easy to say, you go partner and figure out your own little itemized day-to-day, but here are the things you've got to have by these dates. Yeah.
Can you show an example of that?
Yep, definitely.
Identify dependencies. We've talked about that already. And decision-making. So again, color coding, you can say who is responsible for what. Who is responsible, and that can be at the level of who is responsible for doing this, or who is responsible for ensuring that it has been done. Because oftentimes, both types of information is useful on these things. Okay, so in practice, what does that mean? Who's going to be responsible for what? Generally speaking, your project manager or the principal investigator and director are going to be the people who have overall responsibility for everything. That's kind of scary, but ultimately someone has to have the overall responsibility for saying, this is what has to happen, and for being the person who cracks the whip and makes sure that the person who has been promising you that deliverable for the last 3 weeks and now you really are holding everything up needs to absolutely do what they have to do or explain who that is. So the person with the overall responsibility on paper is probably going to be your principal investigator or the project director. In practice, it's going to be your project manager. The reason that the two exist is that sometimes, but although this will never happen in this room, I'm sure, your project manager is the one who goes AWOL. Or it's your project director who goes AWOL. So you have to have the two sets of responsibilities so that each of them are holding the other accountable, right? And that means that there has to be a good relationship, ideally, between the project manager and the PI or project director, because sometimes they have to just say, hey, you're not doing your job, but you also have to be able to move on as equals in a lot of ways. Yeah.
What's the difference between the PI and the director?
Practically very little.
Funding organizations choose the title they like.
Yeah.
So, okay. NEH uses Program Director, Project Director?
Project Director. NSF uses Primary Investigator.
Yeah.
But those two are going to be fulfilling the same
role. They're essentially going to be fulfilling the roles. They are, you know, they're going to be the person whose name went on the grant.
Where there is a difference is if you are working in a sort of organic sense in a center or in an institution that has multiple projects running. Sometimes the director will be, for example, like Neil will be a director sometimes on a project that he's actually got very little to do with, but he's supervising and ensuring that we did our jobs. So sometimes this happens with infrastructure projects, like the vice president for research will be the PI on the project, but he really has nothing to do with it. And that's where there is sometimes a distinction is when projects operate within multiple sorts of...
Yeah. Yeah, but oftentimes that in that situation, the project manager is the person who is assigned the running of the thing, even if they don't use the title project manager. It's kind of the role rather than the title. On the subject of project managers, you're responsible for all of the administrative tasks. That means that you're responsible for making sure that people are getting paid appropriately, that you're dealing with any paperwork that's required for the project. You're probably going to be the person that is responsible for collating, if not writing, the white paper that results at the end of it. Generally speaking, everything that is not the actual nuts and bolts of conducting the research or the technical tasks that were described in your proposal for your project will fall under the remit of the project manager. Technical tasks will be the responsibility of your lead programmer. He might have a team of people working under him, and he is responsible for delegating the work that they have to do. But your project manager needs to know who the lead contact person ideally has a single point of contact within each of the groups that might be working with you, so that there is a clear hierarchical structure that's going on that will help with decision making and ensuring that work has been conducted properly and on time. Website tasks, obviously, is going to be the web developer. Content tasks will typically be the PI, not always, but typically. And by that, in the context of humanities research, that's the humanistic content. You know, it's the data that you're providing. It's the intellectual part of it. We have, both Jen and I have worked on projects where that is not necessarily the case. The digging into data project that we were both a part of, the PI was actually a computer scientist, and we had content specialists who were faculty members who provided guidance as to the humanistic content. But the idea with content tasks is that the PI has the holistic perspective on the whole thing, right? They need to be aware of everything that's going on, just as the project manager does. And then finally, financial tasks as your business manager, if you are lucky enough to have one. If you're in a departmental setting, it's likely to be your departmental secretary. Someone along those lines who you can go to and who will assist you in the process of hiring a graduate student to make sure that that their salary is drawn from the correct account, or who can tell you how much money you have left to spend on X, Y, or Z, that sort of thing. Again, the project manager is going to work really, really closely with all of these different categories, and is going to have perspectives and responsibilities that intersect with all of it. But you can't control everything. There are a lot of things that might go wrong. So you have to be prepared for occasions when your work plan changes. And it might change because someone leaves the university. It might change because you come up against a really hard problem in your programming efforts. It might be that someone thought that a particular set of documents was located in this place where you have an agreement, and you actually go in to find it and discover that, well, actually, it got moved to this other archive 5 years ago and we didn't have a proper paper trail. There are all sorts of things that might go wrong with your work plan. So you have to be adaptable, you have to be flexible, you have to be prepared for the unforeseen, unfortunately. And then the final thing is, you can't control for personalities. A lot of times, if you are working in a center like Myth, you have a team of programmers, a core team of programmers that you know and you trust, but they hire graduate students who are essentially temporary workers, and you hire them and you think that you've got a great graduate student, and it turns out that actually they're much more interested in traveling the country, following your football team as they do whatever, and they get no work. So you can't always anticipate how well someone is going to work. Similarly, if you have a set of collaborators on your project, you might find that one of the faculty members that you're working with is really, really bad about claiming credit that isn't due to him, and creates an environment that isn't conducive to working. Or you might have a business manager who tells you that they've processed all of these receipts for your invited speakers And you find out 3 months later that actually nothing ever happened and they haven't received any of their money. And that actually happened to me at Illinois, where I had a business manager who literally lied to my face when I said, hey, has this been done? And this was like after 3 months of, oh yeah, it's caught up in university administration. Or, yeah, I walked it over today. It's going to happen. She eventually, in this instance, she actually eventually took an unauthorized week off. And one of her coworkers had to go through her desk to find something else. Found a pile of reimbursement receipts this thick that she hadn't processed over the course of the last 6 months. These are the types of things that can and do go wrong.
But it'll never happen to you.
It will never happen to you because, you know, we're telling you about it now, so you know to check this. Right?
Which leaves this whole giant world of other things that also can go wrong.
We're gonna talk all about the problems.
All about the problems. But yeah, and that's the sort of thing that you just, you know, that's a basic function of that person's job. And when someone that is very friendly personably tells you, yes, I literally walked it over and handed it to the appropriate person for them to do, why wouldn't you take that on face value?
People lie all the time.
Right. people do.
Present company.
Okay, so when things do go wrong with your work plan, you have to think through what is the impact of that going to be? And there might be there are a couple of different ways in which you might need to adapt your work plan. The first is an actual change in the scope of your project. This actually will oftentimes require approval from your sponsor if you're doing it, depending on the actual impact that it might have. If you are doing something that means that you're actually only going to be able to deliver half of the deliverables that you had promised, that's something that you need to talk to your sponsor about as early as possible. And things like that are specific technology changes. You know, a major technology change might be that you have been developing in Python and suddenly discover that actually you need to do it in Ruby. A change in mission. You know, if you sold your project on, I'm going to be studying the history of slavery in the South, and suddenly you decide that actually the much more appropriate project for you to be working on is the history of naval battles in the British North Sea. That's something that you probably want to have a conversation with your sponsors. A more common type of change are things that require budget adjustments. And we're going to be talking a lot about budgets tomorrow. But there are a lot of factors that come up that require you to think differently about how you're spending your money. It might be that you discover that the two programmers that you've assigned to this just isn't going to be enough, and that you need to instead hire a third one to do it. And that's going to have budget implications. It's going to have implications in terms of the work plan that you have. Resource changes. If you think that if your university library has promised you that they're buying the latest and greatest digitization tool, and suddenly they don't have it, you might find that you need to allocate money that was originally set aside for salaries and instead put it towards equipment. Partner changes. This happens all the time. You've set up this amazing international collaboration, and then you discover that actually people working in the UK don't like staying until 10 o'clock so that they can meet your 5 o'clock weekly meeting time and drop out. So that might result in a change in the scope of your project. It might change, require a change in who you're actually working with. That example is a bad one because that's the sort of thing that you would have covered before you get started. But you might find that
a faculty member leaves. The core at that institution, the institution can drop out. That's a good example of a partner change that you can't control.
What happens if, like, for instance, a graduate student gets a job, so they have a completely different title and salary change?
So, okay, there are three ways of dealing with this. If you change your status inside your own university, so you're a graduate student who gets hired as an adjunct or a faculty or staff member, you can modify the budget that you got from your funder, and you send it back to them, and you say, because of the change in this person's status, we must redo the budget. You submit a revision. Usually they're okay as long as you're not asking for more money. If you are leaving your university, and Simon and I have both been caught in this as PIs, you have to negotiate with the university you're leaving whether you can take your project with you if you are a staff member or a faculty member. Because when you receive external funding to your project, it goes to the university as a CO. They are caring for it in your name. That means they own it. They ain't going to give up that money. So you have to talk to the university you're at and say, this isn't worth your time because you don't have the right staff, the right knowledge, the right whatever. You need to let me take it with me when I go. Faculty who are well established do this all the time, where if Matt left tomorrow from MIT, Bit Curator would have to go with him because Matt's the only person who does Born Digital Forensics of that style at MIT. You can, however, leave your project behind. I did this at South Carolina last year when I got a new job here. I had written a series of grants, one of them that got awarded for $250,000 because I thought I was going to be in that job for forever, or at least for 5 years. So I wrote a grant, it got awarded for $250,000, and the issue came of me leaving, and the people I was working with were reticent, obviously, because it was such a prestigious grant to let it go. And another digital humanist stepped in and kept the project there. That had repercussions, and I can talk later this afternoon or tomorrow about how I cite that on my CV, because I still take credit for that. And I still take credit, for example, as a graduate student for all of the grants that we wrote that my name were not in the PI name nor in the list of people who got money, because I got paid to write that grant and it won. And we can talk a little bit about on Friday, I think it's probably the best time, how you deal with those scenarios. But it's something you've got to negotiate.
Yeah, I was just gonna. With the grant I'm on now, I mean, I got involved in this situation where the project manager was at my university and actually basically wrote the grant. The project director was another university because it's this consortium sort of grant. She left the grant. She wanted the grant to stay with the university. So when I became the project manager, it was the same amount of money, but they had to change it for the amount of time and the salary because that was different. She was 12 months, not 9 months. She ended up taking the job to become the project director. And there too, I mean, she was different time, different salary, different, so all that. But the NEH was
they're
fine with that. But the overall money has to stay the same, so everything had to be.
Yeah,
it was not fun.
And there is a trick.
There's
a trick to how you formulate the rationale and all that, and we'll talk about that tomorrow. The other case with your example, sadly, is you just replace them. Right, you know, if a graduate student, it depends to a large extent.
So it depends
on the circumstances, but I've absolutely been involved in projects where it's a 2 year project and we've spent time training a student for to do a particular task, and at the end of the spring semester, they said, actually, I've got a better opportunity waiting for me, sorry. And they haven't been prepared to continue on the project themselves. So you have no choice but to simply replace them. And it will depend on the particular project, and it will depend on the particular graduate student or personnel as to what the actual impact of doing that on the project is. So there are all sorts of different considerations that you need to make. Yeah.
I work a lot with private funders, and private funders tend to be a little bit more flexible. For instance, the reason why the ACA staff could come here is that we had a partner pull out of a previous project we were working on totally,
mm-hmm.
and we were able to say to the private funder, listen, they're not doing what you said you wanted to have us do. Can we revert the funds to this, and then we can continue to move in that direction?
Right. So, another scenario is if you've got three graduate students working on your project, one of them drops out, and you feel like the two that are doing it can handle that, you can reallocate that money to some other purpose. The key for a lot of funders is you had an original budget of $250,000. Within general guidelines, and we'll talk about specific budget categories and what you can and can't do with that with category different types of money tomorrow. But as long as you aren't going to come and ask us for another $50,000 to do this, we more or less, it's not that we don't care, but we're very flexible and understanding. Okay, so there are also times when you might decide that a change is necessary to your work plan. And that might be that someone leaves. It might be that they're not performing their job, and they're not meeting the deliverables, or it might simply be that the deliverables were too ambitious in the first place, and instead of taking 3 months, it's now clear it's going to take 6 months. There are a lot of times that personality issues might come up, that partners come and go, resources disappear. Those are types of issues and types of questions that hopefully won't come up, but might. There are also occasions when your funders or other stakeholders will actually come to you and say, we need you to make this change. So you need to be flexible and adapt to that situation. Sometimes, if it means more work, they will come to you and say, hey, we have another $50,000 that we will give you if you are able to do this as well. More often, they come to you and say, hey, we want you to do all this extra work, but you need to do it under the terms of the original budget constraints. So you need to think through what impact that might have. And then finally, when change is needed, when your PI isn't doing their job, and that sadly happens quite a lot, where PIs commit to do things and faculty and staff are actually really busy, and they don't anticipate that they anticipate that they're going to be able to commit the time to doing the project in the way in which it's described in the in your proposal, but actually when it comes down to it, they realize that juggling all of the different balls that they have in the air at any one time is just impossible with this one thrown in as well. So how do you work through the process of a PI basically going MIA? And that really is where the project manager has to step in and take much more of a leadership role. It's obviously going to depend a little bit on what role the PI originally had in the proposal. If the PI is someone who is just basically there for window dressing, it's less of a problem than if they're providing the intellectual direction, because as many things as I know about, I don't know very much about battles in the North Sea. So I'm not going to be able to provide all of that. But your job is to help think through the process of what the implication of these potential changes in funding, in time management, in resources, in equipment failure might have on your actual project. When is change allowed? We've kind of covered a lot of this. When it doesn't cost you. basically, or when it doesn't cost the funder. Specifically, when it doesn't cost them more money. Oftentimes, when it doesn't cost them more time. That really depends on who the funder is and what your project is. As we've talked about, both NSF and NEH are actually very good about allowing what are called no-cost extensions, where they basically say, you basically write a justification as to why you might need an additional 6 months or 12 months to finish a project. And as long as you haven't spent all of your money, they are generally willing to do it, as long as there isn't a time-critical component to the project. And also, change is often allowed when you aren't completely changing the scope of the project. So going into NEH and saying, hey, we want to do a workshop on for humanists to understand topic modeling. It's going to be a two-day event. Is a very different proposition to going to them and saying, hey, we want to develop topic model algorithms and teach over a sustained period of 4 weeks how to use them. They're linked tangentially, but they involve different types of deliverables, different additional deliverables. And that's the sort of thing that they aren't going to look very favorably on, because your original project was assessed and awarded money based on what you had originally promised. So you can make the change when you are going to deliver a better product to them. So if you are working on an algorithm and it's like 75% there, but you can say to them that this additional 6 months is going to allow us to improve accuracy from 90% to 99%. That's the sort of change that they will look very favorably upon with no-cost extensions. They will look favorably upon requests when you can point to an increased impact on the project, where you can say, okay, so we're asking for this additional money to allow us to go out to conferences so that we can publicize our results, or that we need this additional time so that we can properly develop an additional outreach program to it. It's also worth making a change if it will better position you for the next phase of the project. I talked a little bit with a couple of you yesterday about how NEH actually structures their digital humanities grants so that they build upon each other. They start with an NEH level 1 startup grant, then a level 2 startup grant, and then an implementation grant. And then beyond that, there are all sorts of other funding opportunities available to you. Each type of grant has an increasing amount of money attached to it, $30,000, $60,000, $200,000. The specific goal of that structure is that if you apply for a level 1 grant, that you are going to, at the end of it, hopefully have a product that you can then reapply for the next phase of the product as either a level 2 or as an implementation grant. And actually, when NEH awarded the first round of implementation grants 12 months ago, they made a very, very big deal about how 75% of the grants had been previous awardees under the startup project. So it's worth thinking in your, when you are putting together your list of objectives and your list of deliverables, what are the next steps? How can I position this? You can't literally say one of my deliverables is going to be a proposal to the NEH implementation grant. They won't look very kindly on that. But you can talk about how it will position you for that, and it should be part of your proposal, your thought process as you're creating your work plan. Having said that, scope creep happens an awful lot. You know? This is when someone comes in and they get really excited about your project and they say, well, wouldn't it be really great to apply it to this as well? And, you know, that's great. That's really exciting. It really feels good when someone it affirms the importance of your project and wants to apply it to their own problem, but that's not the place for funded research. As I said, your proposal was awarded based on a specific set of deliverables in a specific intellectual context. NEH isn't going to want to see it suddenly change course 90 degrees. It also happens when projects begin to get press. You know, when you've created a successful project and DH now features it on your Twitter feed. That's very tempting to then listen to all of the suggestions that come in and to try and take into consideration all of those suggestions, and a lot of them will be great suggestions, but that is probably going to be the next phase of your project, not the current one. And scope creep also happens when your staff changes. You know, my interests are very different intellectually to Jen's. We have different agendas personally in our research, so you can't just swap us in and out and expect it to be a 100% exactly the same, because she isn't as interested as I am in social media research, for example. That's one of my priorities at Clemson. Likewise, I'm not especially interested in the history of sports mascots. Partly because I should be, but I grew up in the UK where we think this notion of you guys going crazy over college sports is ridiculous. but the point is that a new staff member who is involved is going to look at the project differently from your original personnel, and is going to suggest different functionality, different capabilities. So you need to be aware of that that issue. So what you need to think about is, does our current scope accomplish our primary goals? And by primary goals, it's the goals that you actually originally outlined in your proposal when way back on slide one, an hour and a half ago when we started on this. Are the stakeholders pleased? You know, it's probably a good idea to be aware, and certainly with NSF, also with NEH now, for multi-year projects, they will request an annual report on progress. And so it's an opportunity for you to evaluate where you are, evaluate as you're working on the project, what is going right, what is going wrong, to readjust accordingly, but also to get feedback from your stakeholders as to how they feel things are going. And then finally, is the project team enjoying its work? You know, I mean, yes, they're hired to do a job, but oftentimes, I mean, all the time, really, you're going to have more productive workers if they're enjoying what they're doing. And sometimes it might be that you can swap someone out who isn't enjoying what they're doing with someone who might enjoy it more. So, when a project actually does become so painful that you can't continue, the first thing to do is to identify how to get out of there as quickly as you can. You know, how can you finish the project as quickly as you can while still meeting the requirements of your original proposal? One thing is to basically skim it down. Make it as streamlined as possible. Focus in on just the core tasks at hand. Don't force your team to have weekly meetings if monthly meetings will suffice. Put on the side this really cool visualization tool that you were going to add to your website if it doesn't form part of the core experience of what you originally proposed. And most importantly of all, be upfront and honest about what is and isn't working. If people are just quietly battling away at something and it isn't going well, but they're not telling anyone, there's nothing that we can do about it. If you do need to change the project scope, and I promise I'm almost done, because I'm sure everyone's getting hungry. If you do need to change the project scope, you need to get everyone together so that they can discuss what the problems are. You need to write up what changes you are proposing with a memorandum so that everyone is on the same page. Everyone needs to be in agreement with it, or at least comfortable with it if they don't necessarily agree with it. Because oftentimes you will find that you need to do a change of scope in the project, and the person who originally dreamed up the project is his baby. And by gosh, you're not going to mess with my baby. But sometimes what they want to do is just impossible. The technology isn't there yet, or the expertise isn't there yet. So you need to get everyone on the same page as to what you're going to do to finish the project is to the best of your abilities. And that memorandum is going to update the project work plan. It's going to update who is responsible for what. And then finally, you need to tell the stakeholders. Sometimes that involves asking the permission of the stakeholders, if your stakeholder is a funding agency. But you don't want to find yourself in a situation where in month 6 of a 3-year project, you have substantially narrowed the scope of what you are doing, and then you write your final report, and that's the point at which the funding agency discovers that, wait, you didn't deliver on deliverables 7 through 10. What the hell? That's going to cause problems. It's going to cause bad blood between you and your funder, and it's going to directly impact your ability to get additional funding moving forward because you weren't upfront, you weren't honest with them. And oftentimes it's not a situation where it's better to ask forgiveness rather than permission. It's better to ask permission rather than forgiveness in this instance. And then finally, what are the things that you should look at to identify potential problems in your work plan before you actually get down to it? And, you know, this is kind of like, well, duh, it's either too broad or too, you know, it's too hot or it's too cold. This one's just right. And really, you know, the way to think about it, a lot of it will come with experience, but also it's common sense. So if you have a work plan that is literally just 5 bullets, probably it's going to be too broad, especially if it's a multi-year project or a year-long project. If, on the other hand, you have a work plan that is going to say, week 1, 9 a.m. meeting, all hands. Week 2, 9 a.m. meeting, all hands. If it's going to say things like, confirm with business manager that hire X has gone through, that's too specific. So you're looking at your main objectives followed by a list of the components that make it up. And they need to be just specific enough that they get the overall sense without overwhelming both you and your sponsor and your team members on the details of what's going on.